Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with excuse me, with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. and every Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also hear this show on Podomatic.com, usually within a few days of the show's airing. Also on YouTube, visit our YouTube channel. And by the way, our YouTube channel, we're closing in on 1 million views. So please, if you haven't already, visit the YouTube channel, subscribe to it and share it. Watch the videos, download them, and make them available to people in your circles and people not even in your circles. This show is brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And next year's camp will be held where it was held this year at the Lakeside Christian Camp and Conference Center in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, July 28th to August 3rd. And you can go to our website, campconstitution.net, to find out more, not just about the camp, but some of the other wonderful things that we make available, our Speakers Bureau, our Sam Blumenfeld Archive, our YouTube channel, our Facebook page, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I got a couple of things I want to address. One of them is this incredible article that goes back to the early 70s called Sugar Canes, about John Maynard Keynes and his supporters and his circle of intimates. But before I get into that, I want to address this plastic bag ban that you'll see not just happening, it's happening all over the United States and all over the world. And here in Boston, Boston, Massachusetts, the ban goes into effect in a few days. So what this does is the little bags that that grocery stores and other stores use that are a wonderful, convenient product, they'll be banned. Now, why is this happening? Why was it determined that these bags are evil? And where do they have the power? If they can ban a plastic bag, they can ban other things. And it all goes back to something called Agenda 21. And this is what far too few people understand. Some people will argue, well, they get into the stream and they do this, so they get into the woods and to the lakes and what have you, and then they don't break down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is the Agenda 21, which comes out of was an event that came out of Rio de Janeiro in 1993. They came out with this 40-chapter document called Agenda 21. And it was supposed to be binding upon everyone in the everybody in the world. And it took a while for it to be implemented. And one of the terms that came out of this is sustainable development. And certain things were considered non-sustainable. And by the way, at this Agenda 21 function, it was determined that the biggest threat to the world wasn't nuclear war. It wasn't fundamentalist Muslim terrorists. It wasn't the Soviet or the breakup of the Soviet Union and the consequences of that. It was the American middle class. Why? Because of our living consumption patterns. Because we have single family homes and we have yards that with grass that need to be cut, and that we usually have two cars per family, in some cases more than that. And that, et cetera, that we eat meat and that we have to drive to work, burning fossil fuels. So we have air conditioning and we have heat in our homes. That's usually oil or gas. And this is unsustainable. And if people understood that, they'd be able to look at these types of things. Many cities and towns have redesigned their streets. They've changed them. The streets aren't any bigger, but you've got fewer lanes. And in many cases, you're driving down the road, all of a sudden you see a bike lane, and you're not sure what lane you're in, if you're in a bike lane, if you're in the regular driving lane, or what. And then somebody who thinks he's saving the planet, or she's saving the planet by bicycling to work on roads that were not designed for bicycles, gets clobbered. And this is, well, what's this all about? It's all part of Agenda 21 that's been rebranded, and some people say it's different, like Agenda 2030 or Agenda 2050. And these big cities and even small towns, they're talking about we want to be carbon neutral by 2030 or 2050. It's all insane. It's not. In fact, the plastic bags, I just spoke to my good friend Willie Soon, and he said a report's going to come out in a few days about plastic bags. And in fact, they are more beneficial to the environment than they are negative. But just think of, you know, in our own home, we use the plastic bags for many things. We get them from supermarkets. We use them for trash liners. We use them for, my wife has a daycare business. They use this to store dirty diapers. We use them to tote books around. We use them to put them in the freezer bags, and many, many other things. And now we still have the need for these plastic bags. Now we're going to have to buy them. And then when we go to the grocery store, we're going to have to buy the paper bags, 5 cents, 10 cents, unless we bring our recycled bag or reusable bag. And the reusable bags are not that environmental friendly. We think, oh, we're touchy-feely. We're using a user bag. But these things take energy to make and to create. And because of that, they're less efficient than a plastic bag. But you see, people don't know this. And the problem is this agenda is being rammed down the people's throats. They're not giving even notice. We don't know why it's happening, but hey, we just accept it. You know, this is bad. And we go on to the next. What's the next thing that the towns are going to ban or the city of Boston is going to ban? Bottled water, straws, you name it. You know, everything that's deemed unsustainable. They may say in a few years you can't have more than one car or you can't have any cars. You know, you have to commute everywhere you go, you know. Would make it so difficult to own a car. They may not outright ban them, but they'll raise the taxes so high. So these are the kinds Agenda 21 in action, and people really got to get behind this and understand what's going on, because these folks won't stop. They won't stop until they get their agenda completed, and we'll be living in a third world country, because it's impossible. It's impossible to run a country zero carbon, carbon free, or carbon neutral. The only way to do that is to die. You build up a carbon neutral building. Well, what do you think creates, how you get the building materials? What do you think? They're not created by, you think the cement companies are using wind turbines and solar panels to produce the cement or the concrete or the iron or the metal or all the different products that go into building a house or a building? You think the steam shovels and the excavators and all of the equipment they use, you think they're using wind turbines to do this? You know, do you think the infrastructure, when they have to change infrastructure in the neighborhood to accommodate this new building, you think that they're going to be using wind turbines and solar panels to generate energy to make this happen? Of course not. If you visit our website, we've got some good items on the subject. In our YouTube channel, we have quite a few videos dealing with Agenda 21. I gave a presentation, I think it was last summer, and of course I've done a lot of presentations, but if you go to our YouTube channel, just put on Agenda 21, it gives you a good thumbnail sketch, but also how to fight it. And we've had some great success stories. The town of Ridge, New Hampshire, where a camp used to be held, had a Agenda 21 was creeping into this little rural town, and it was in 2012. I was visiting the town hall, leaving information off on the subject, by the way, and on the desk in this little town hall was something called, it was a printout. It was called the Ringe Charrette. Now, a charrette is a visionary session, and a visionary session is one of these gatherings where the outcome has already been determined, but we come to these people thinking that they have some input. This is something that the RAND Corporation put together many years ago to get buy-in. And when people leave this meeting, they think they had something to do with it. So this charrette was talking about what Ridge will look like so many years from now, and they'll be within the next 10 years, and all of this sustainable development. Well, I saw this, and I knew right away what a charrette was. And I wrote a letter to the local newspaper. I don't know if the letter was actually published, but I copied and pasted the letter into the Facebook page of the town of Ridge. They've since changed the policy. And that got some people on the left who were implementing this. That got those people riled up, and they were vilifying me. But some of the good folks in town who didn't care for these people on the left, they didn't know what Agenda 21 was. So they got a hold of me. They got schooled pretty quickly. They did a few people especially did a lot of research. And they held a meeting at my suggestion in October of that year, 2012. And over 200 people showed up, and in the wake of that, they created a little organization called Save Our Town. They had what they call warrant articles on the city of this town's election in March, and they had three or four warrant articles. All were passed, all of them aimed against Agenda 21. One of them was that when HUD is the Housing and Urban Development, which is another entity implementing this all over the country, that when HUD money comes into town, it has to be voted on in the general election, not just accepted by the town manager or a planning committee member. And it also said that the charrette will be taken off the town's master plan and that they will leave the regional planning commission. And these regional planning commissions are the ones that are also implementing Agenda 21 policies. And they got rid of a solar panel project that was in the planning stages. It wasn't actually implemented, but planning stages. And the town manager resigned. And I think that there were three selectmen. I think two of them were elected who were pro-liberty. And it made a big impact in that town. It basically saved the town. So these things can be successful, but people have to be aware, be willing to, you know, to invest some time and even some money to fight this. So again, if you don't educate yourself on this subject, and it's happening all over the world. So you might be listening to this, on a shortwave station. And when I notice that in the United States, when I get the Google alerts on Agenda 21, they don't use the term Agenda 21. But in other parts of the world, they use the term Agenda 21. They don't seem to have a problem with it. But here in the United States, it's become controversial. So they just change the rebrand things. And that's what they do. So now, getting back to this article that I mentioned when the show began. Let's see. Hopefully I'll have time to. I have time. This came out of a publication that's now defunct. It was called Review of the News, which was a weekly publication. The author was someone who was very familiar to me, Zygmunt Dobbs. Zygmunt Dobbs wrote a number of books exposing the Fabian socialists and the Marxists, and this was done in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. And this was June 23rd, 1971, and Sugar Keynes was the name of the article, and he was talking about John Maynard Keynes. It's spelled K-E-Y-N-E-S, but it's pronounced Keynes, like candy canes or sugar canes. So I'm going to read some of the excerpts of this reprint, and anyone who would like to copy of it, I can scan it and make it available. It's not that long of an article, but this is the Fabian Socialists, by the way. And I want to point out that Richard Nixon in the early 70s said, "We are all Keynesians now." This is the Republican conservative that said, this is the worldview that we have, the economic perspective we have. We're all Keynesians now. I think he said that when he announced his wage and price control nonsense. So here the article's beginning here. Singing the red flag, the highborn sons of the British upper class lay on the carpeted floor spinning out socialist schemes in homosexual intermission. Sometimes one of the participants would shout out an obscenity. Then, as if on signal, the entire group would join in a frenzied babble of profanity. Here and there, individuals would smoke or chew hashish. Most had unkempt long hair and some sported beards. The attitude in such gatherings was anti-establishmentarian. To them, the older generation was horribly out of date, even superfluous. The capitalist system was declared obsolete and revolution was proclaimed as the only solution. Christianity was pronounced an enemy force, and the worst sort of depravities were eulogized as that love which passes all Christian understanding. The year was 1904, and the participants were destined to become the intellectual and political leaders of the British Empire. Chief of this ring of homosexual revolutionaries was John Maynard Keynes, who eventually became the economic architect of the English socialism and gravedigger for the British Empire. The chief American Fabians acting as carriers of the Keynesian sickness were Felix Frankfurter and Walter Lippmann. Covertly, they mobilized their leftist comrades to spread this pollution in America also. So successful were they that on January 4th, 1971, President Richard Nixon announced, "I am now a Keynesian in economics." What does that mean? Keynes was characterized by his male sweetheart, Lytton Strachey, as a liberal and a sodomite, an atheist and a statistician. His particular depravity was the sexual abuse of little boys. In communications to his homosexual friends, Keynes advised that they go to Tunis, where bed and boy were also non-expensive. As a sodomistic pedophilic, he ranged throughout the Mediterranean area in search of boys for himself and his fellow socialists, taking full advantage of the bitter poverty and abysmal ignorance in North Africa, the Middle East, and Italy, he purchased the bodies of children prostituted for English shillings. Such leftist hypocrites then, as now, issued loud denunciations against poverty, imperialism, and capitalist immorality. However, for their own degenerate purposes, they eagerly sought out the worst pockets of destitution and backwardness to satisfy their perverted purposes through sexual enslavement of youngsters. While traveling in France and the United States, they complained among themselves of the harassment by the police of practicing homosexuals in degenerate areas of the Mediterranean. On the other hand, they found a pervert's utopia where the bodies of children could be purchased as part of a cultured socialist holiday. These leftist degenerates began to scheme over 60 years ago to secure public acceptance of their depravity. Havelock Ellis, the founder of the Fabian Society, compiled a massive erotic work entitled Studies in the Psychology of Sex. Ellis was a sex pervert and drug user. He and a group of fellow leftists even pioneered in the experimental use of hallucinogens in private orgies. Ellis was definitely a pathological case. He drove his wife into lesbianism and drug addiction, securing additional erotic excitement by urging her to recite her lesbian experiences. Mrs. Ellis eventually went insane and died in utmost misery after denouncing her husband as a sexual monster. The Fabian socialists used the writings of Ellis as a wedge for sex education in the schools. They started in the colleges and gradually eased into the high school level. Ellis complained to his fellow socialists 55 years ago that he found wider acceptance for his books in the United States than he did in England. In fact, he was arrested and tried for obscenity in England, whereas his books were sold here without serious interference by the authorities. Today, his perversions are standard reference materials for the sex educators, and Havelock Ellis is popularly called the father of social psychology. Keynes and his cohort seized upon the works of Ellis as justification for their depravities. They were also greatly bolstered in their campaign by the theories of an Austrian leftist named Sigmund Freud. Dr. Freud acknowledged in private correspondence that he copied the thesis of sex as the central determinant in human action from Havelock Ellis. Echoing Ellis, he laid down the premise that homosexuality and carnal depravities are not a matter of abnormality, but merely a case of personal preference. This, plus his declaration of atheism, overjoyed the socialist Keynesian crowd. John Maynard Keynes audaciously proclaimed, "Sex questions are about to enter the political arena." He inveighed against the treatment of sexual offense as abnormalities, adding that charge that the existing state of the law and the orthodox is still medieval, altogether out of touch with civilized opinion and civilized practice, and with what individuals, educated and uneducated alike, say to one another in private. During the same period, 1925, Keynes struck out against drug control. He laid down the line which had been pursued by leftists to the present day in demanding that distribution of narcotics be unrestricted. Homosexuals find drugs a useful adjunct in loosening moral inhibitions to perversion, and this ravisher of little boys feigned sympathy for the masses by urging universal rights for users of narcotics. He declared, "How far is bored and suffering humanity to be allowed from time to time to escape an excitement, a stimulus, a possibility of change?" Keynes and his conspirators projected homosexuality and drug addiction as an intrinsic part of their collective society of the future. His male sweetheart, Lytton Strachey, wrote privately that they would corrupt the whole population subtly through literature into the bloodstream of the people, and in such a way that they accepted it all naturally, if need be, without at first realizing what it is to which they were agreeing. This, by the way, is a direct quote. He boasted that he intended to, quote, "seduce his readers to tolerance through laughter and sheer entertainment," unquote. He pointed out that his object was, quote, "to write in a way that would contribute to an eventual change in our ethical and sexual mores, a change that couldn't be done in a minute, but would unobtrusively permeate the more flexible minds of young people," close quote. J.M. Keynes put it in the terms of Marxist economics, and this is a quote from Keynes. "When the accumulation of wealth is no longer of high social importance, there will be a great change in the code of morals. We shall be able to rid ourselves of many pseudo-moral principles which have hag-ridden us for 200 years. Keynes and Strachey used their malignant writings to help contaminate the entire English-speaking world. In the United States, they both found expression in the New Republic, the New York Times, and the Saturday Review of Literature. In 1939, a comrade of Keynes and Strachey named Bertrand Russell came to America to push their obscenitarian socialism in, was, he says in his autobiography, legally charged as lecherous, libidinous, lustful, venerous, erotomania, aphrodisiac, irrelevant, narrow-minded, untruthful, and benefit of moral fiber. His aborted object had been to permeate the College of the City of New York with the corruption of the British Fabians. Immediately, John Dewey and other American Fabians organized to cry this academic freedom was under attack. The National Education Association and the whole leftist educational complex began to percolate pervasive degeneracies as being liberal and progressive. The works of Keynes, Lytton Strachey, and Bertrand Russell have been and are today required reading in almost every college and university in the United States and Canada. In the spring of 2005, Keynes and his Lavender cohorts had been thrilled by a conference of Russian revolutionaries in London, British Fabians, and Joseph Fels, an American soap manufacturer, who was also a Fabian, had financed a Russian gathering and furnished them a hall in a Christian church. Key revolutionaries at this London conference included Lenin, Leon Trotsky, and Joseph Stalin. The future slaughter of 50 million civilians and the conquest of one-third of the Earth's surface rested within the shelter of this gathering. Shivers of excitement rippled down the spines of the socialist homosexuals when they heard that Lenin had openly defended the slaughter of bank guards and stealing of bank funds for the Bolshevik coffers. During this time, Strachey wrote to one of his intimates, "At the moment, Keynes is lying on a rug beside me." Keynes and his fellow debauchees became active pacifists and conscientious objectors during World War I. The socialist position against military service dovetailed perfectly with the homosexual aversion to any kind of physical danger and the manly requirements of military training. Yet in spite of Keynes' sheltering of queer conscience, in quotation marks here, and his own refusal to serve his country, he was made the head of an important division of the British Treasury. During March of 1917, he confided privately that he supported the Bolshevik group among the Russian socialists after the overthrow of Tsar Nicholas. The seizure of power by the Bolsheviks in November of 1917 elated Keynes and the rest of the Fabian coterie. At leftist parties in London, Keynes and his fellow perverts celebrated by dressing in women's clothes and performing lewd dances. He had as his consort an 18-year-old boy who was ensconced as his assistant in the Treasury Department. Just before the Bolshevik Revolution, Keynes had made a hurried trip to the United States for the British government. Here we had a chance to make contact with American Fabians who were similarly entrenched via the Frankfurt-Lippmann Group in key positions in the Wilson administration. Even the House of Morgan in New York City's financial district trotted out its sissies to welcome Keynes to this country and gave him an office just for himself. The international grapevine established the nature of his proclivities. The urbane air of Keynes sent thrills of excitement through the ranks of the financial giggle gang, and that's in quotation marks. Keynes' deviate socialist circle was almost completely pro-Bolshevik. 1 month after the revolution, J.M. Keynes wrote his mother, "Well, the only course open to me is to be buoyantly Bolshevik. And as I lie in bed this morning, I reflect with a good deal of satisfaction that because of our rules are as incompetent as they are mad and wicked, one particular era, a particular kind of civilization is very nearly over." On February 22nd, 1918, Keynes proudly boasted of being a Bolshevik. Yet the British government blindly sent Keynes to the Versailles peace talks. There he joined forces with his Fabian American comrade, Walter Lippmann, who was among those representing the equally blind U.S. government. The ensuing pro-Bolshevik and anti-American machinations were largely responsible not only for laying out the basis for continuing Red victories, but also for setting up the chain of events that eventually brought Hitler to power. In 1919, Keynes authored The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which he promptly acclaimed from Moscow by Nikol Lenin himself. The Red dictator declared, "Nowhere has the Versailles Treaty been more described as well in the book by Keynes." A special edition of The Economic Consequences was printed under the label of the Fabian Society in Frankfurt, and Lippmann brought the manuscript to the United States and arranged with Harcourt and Brace to publish it here. The volume became required reading among American socialists and communists. However, Keynes' value as a hidden Red was in danger. The Fabians had developed a posture of respectability to a fine art, and the value of Keynes' book was an impartial work, was in jeopardy. With Keynes' future usefulness in upper-class circles at stake, Lenin had personally come to the rescue. He pulled the classic leftist double twist, praising Keynes' book as a model for communist revolutionaries and at the same time covering for Keynes by labeling him an anti-Bolshevik. Nicole Lennon rose before the Second Congress of the Communist International and declared, "I will quote another economic source which assumes particularly great significance, the British diplomat Keynes, the author of The Economic Consequences of the Peace, who, on the instructions of his government, took part in the Versailles Peace Treaty. Watch them directly from the purely bourgeois point of view. Study the subject step by step and took part in the conference as an economist. He arrived at conclusions which are stronger, more striking, and more instructive than any a communist revolutionary could advance because they are conclusions drawn by an acknowledged bourgeois." Let's see, I got a few more minutes, so I think I can finish this up. In 1925, John Maynard Keynes was married. It was a bizarre performance. His best man was Duncan Grant, his male lover for many years. Intimates swear that Keynes held Duncan's hand as the marriage vows were spoken. But the background of the bride was equally odd. She was Lydia Lopakova, the premier ballerina of the Dashkovil, I can't pronounce that, Dagalev Ballet. She was a habitue of leftist circles and had at one time been engaged to Heywood Broun, the well-known socialist and confidant of Leon Trotsky, but had broken the engagement to marry a dwarf named Barakoli. In 1917, Lydia had disappeared in Paris with a top Cossack general of the White Army, returning to the ballet when the general returned to lead his troops against the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviki had by now, however, acquired advance information and used it to defeat the Cossacks. Following the wedding to Comrade Lydia, Mr. and Mrs. Keynes were the special guests of the Soviet government. He and his Russian wife were allowed free access to the Soviet hinterland, even to the extent of visiting her relatives. This was a privilege unheard of at the time, since even members of the Communist International were not allowed such unlimited travel. It was a time of mass killing of civilians, and ordinary a Russian nationalist traveling with an Englishman would have been arrested and shot. But Soviet officials were effusive in their thanks to Keynes for designing the first Soviet currency for them, while he was still a member of the British Treasury. The marriage was definitely an arrangement, as Keynes continued to enjoy his amours with men. This was often the case with upper-class homosexuals who needed a legal wife as a facade. They both had separate living quarters and did not interfere with the personal lives of one another. Lydia was very useful as a go-between, since Keynes was in frequent contact with Soviet officials, both in Britain and the United States. Meanwhile, the perversion continued apace. It was quite apace, as I have noted in the new edition of Keynes at Harvard. Yeah, I get about 2 minutes left here. Keynes had relations with Strachey. Strachey had affairs with Duncan Grant. Keynes stole Grant from Strachey. Lytton's brother, James Strachey, adored Rupert Brooks, but so did Keynes. Strachey reports to G.E. Moore on seduction of new boys. Keynes steals Edgar Duckworth from Lytton. Keynes and Lytton agree that homosexuality is that love which passes all Christian understanding. Strachey emulates Oscar Wilde with absinthe and drugs. He also declares that the whole truth is the devil. He predicts that in 100 years, everyone will be converted to homosexuality. Well, they're getting close, aren't they? This is my editorial here, my only editorial. Strachey and Keynes promote obscenitarian talk in colleges. Lytton lives with Dora Carrington, a lesbian. Carrington solicits homosexual partners for Lytton. Keynes, Lytton, and Carrington have orgies involving lesbian and sodomistic interchanges, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm almost done. There's only a few, another paragraph or two. But this demonstrates what happened. When people say, what happened in this country? It was a slow process. We got used to certain things. And before you know it, we are where we are today, where if you say that a certain lifestyle is a sin, you are a hater and a bigot. But this was laid down well over 100 years ago. And that comment by Strachey said that we'll have a homosexual world in 100 years. If he said that in 1925, boy, I tell you, we're getting close. Well, anyway, folks, with that, I want to thank you. Until next week, may God bless you.